Thank you so much, Christina, and thanks so much also for the invitation, of course. It's actually my first time in Canada, so it was very nice to add another country to the list. And so this is some work that I did with other people in Saclay, Raffaele, who many of you know, and then Florian, who was a postdoc there, now he left, and Pablo, who is a PhD student in our group. So I want to give a little bit of a general introduction before I start getting into the details of our work. And just to set the stage, in general, you know, in particle physics, we are concerned with quite fundamental questions, you could say. So a couple of examples of those are where does mass come from? Where does mass come from? So what is the origin of mass? Or also we might ask something like, you know, what is the universe made of? What is the composition of the universe? And as you go ahead and, you know, study those questions, you eventually encounter some further problems or further questions, you know, in your search. So in the case of, let's say, the origin of mass, you might encounter the hierarchy problem, which is the question of why the Higgs is light the way that we measure it to be, in a certain sense. And, you know, as part of the composition of the universe, you find evidence for a different kind of matter, which we call dark matter, compared to, you know, conventional just baryonic matter. And, you know, in the past, what people have done is, you know, study extensions of the standard model in which you could explain and find the answers to these questions. And the typical examples, let's say in the case of the hierarchy problem, was to add some sort of symmetry to explain the mass of the Higgs. And this symmetry was, you know, came to be around the scale of the Higgs itself, so around the weak scale. So examples can be, you know, supersymmetry or composite Higgs models in which you expect that as you probe the energy scale that characterizes the Higgs and then you keep going above that in energy, then you would encounter new states, new particles that would tell you about you know, the solution of the hierarchy problem that nature had chosen. And in the same way, also if you have a particular scenario for dark matter, such as the WIMP scenario, you might also expect to find, as an example, new particles around the weak scale. Okay, and so in some scenarios, at least, what the common predictions of these scenarios were was that we were going to find, you know, new physics at the weak scale, so around the scale that we were going to probe with particle colliders, such as the LHC. Now, you know, this is just to say that, you know, many years ago, or around 20 years ago, when we started working on LHC, then we had a certain picture of what was going to happen once we started collecting data and doing physics with LHC. The prediction was, you know, metaphorically something like this, okay? So we expected that we were going to, you know, turn on LHC and we were going to, you know, collect the fruits of our hard work and find, you know, new particles that could be, you know, the Higgs, but also, again, these new states that were going to tell us more about the you know, the solutions of the questions that we had posed. So these could be, you know, new supersymmetric states in the case of supersymmetry, or also in the case of composite Higgs, again, it could be resonances of this new strong dynamics. Okay, so if this was our expectation, that the reality that we eventually got was quite different, okay? So we got essentially only one fruit that we had to pick, which was the Higgs, but we didn't get to find anything else, at least so far, okay? And this means that we had to kind of revise our expectation for what we were doing also in a certain sense. So we kind of, you know, our attitude also shifted as a consequence of finding something different than what we expected. So, okay, so before LHC, you know, physicists had a certain attitude, had a certain way of dealing with things that was kind of dominated by model building in a certain sense, okay? So we were very focused on working out the exact details and the exact predictions of a certain model, and trying to accommodate experimental data in the best way within the model that that we were considering at a certain point. So, for example, we were going to study the MSSM or whatever supersymmetric extension of the standard model and figure out exactly how to probe that in experiment, or how we could interpret the data in terms of the particular model that we were dealing with. On the other hand, more recently, after we haven't found other particles, after the Higgs, the attitude has been quite different. Okay, so we have been focusing on a different kind of attitude in a certain sense, which is the point of view of effective field theory, which means that you try to interpret the experimental results that you find in a more model-independent way by having a set of higher dimensional operators that are supposed to parameterize your new physics beyond the standard model. And you can reinterpret your experimental result as bounds to the coefficients of these higher dimensional operators. Okay. So of course, these are two different attitudes in a sense, but they both have their merits, okay? And they're both, perfectly valid. But it would be nice to find a picture, and it is nice to find a picture in which you can kind of take some aspects of each of these two and try to put them together, okay? So today, I want to give you an example of a case in which this is possible. Okay, so this long motivation is essentially to tell you that we're trying to do something that is able to put together a bit of the model building attitude and the EFT attitude, and I want to try to explain why. So the intuition for what we want to do can be understood qualitatively, at least, from these sets of diagrams. Okay, so suppose that you have some extension of the standard model that contributes in some way to the mass of the Higgs. Okay. So then you will go ahead and calculate in your model what the effects of this extension of the standard model is, so what the contributions are for BSM to the mass of the Higgs. And the general observation that I want to point out is that, well, generically again, once you have these contributions to the mass of the Higgs, more often than not, then you will also have some contributions to the production and decay of the Higgs itself. Okay, so this is just to say that whenever you have corrections to the Higgs mass, you often expect also corrections to the Higgs couplings. Okay, and this is something that you might intuitively expect already. But the question that we want to answer and what we want to do is to try to find a way to make a model-independent statement that turns this qualitative picture into, again, a quantitative one in which you can calculate something and calculate the relationship between physics beyond the standard model and the effect. So new physics, essentially, in new bosons beyond the standard model and the effect that it has on the couplings of the Higgs, on some particular couplings of the Higgs. So this was just my introduction, but now let me get a bit more into, the intuitive idea of what we are doing. And then I will tell you a bit more of the details of what we have done, and finally show you some results. So just to again be very clear about what we are trying to do, this is the basic question that we're trying to answer. Okay, so suppose that there is a deviation in some couplings of the Higgs. In particular, we focus on Higgs to WW and Higgs to ZZ couplings, and I will explain why we do that. Then the question is, what can we say once we have measured this deviation? What can we say about the scale of new bosons beyond the standard model? Okay, so this is kind of the connection that we are trying to make. All right, so the logic that we tried to use was already in a sense pointed out by these authors here, but. Just to give you again a sense of the logic that we're trying to use, we are working essentially by contradiction. Okay, so we want to construct a theory that, first of all, by assumption, has no new bosons beyond the standard model. Okay, so the initial assumption is that we have some deviation in these couplings of the Higgs, And then we are extending the standard model to explain this deviation with only BSM fermions. Okay, so by assumption, we start with new bosons, with no new bosons beyond the standard model. So for now, the fermions will be in a generic representation. And if you wanted the fermions to be responsible for this deviation that you assume you already measured, then the way you can do it at the renormalizable level is through a Yukawa interaction between these new fermions L and N and the Higgs. Okay, and that's the only way you can do it at the renormalizable level with new fermions. Now, the effect of having this interaction is actually twofold. Okay, so there are two things that you're doing. So one, you are, well, causing this deviation in these couplings of the Higgs that you're trying to explain. But the second thing that you are doing is that you are also modifying the renormalization group evolution of your theory above the scale at which these fermions appear. And at some point, you find that you encounter an instability in the RGEs that you write down, okay? So essentially, said in another way, your theory becomes unstable above a certain calculable energy scale. And the point is that the only way to fix this instability is by introducing new bosons, okay? So that's where your contradiction comes in, essentially. At that scale at which the theory becomes unstable, the only thing that you can do to make it stable again is to introduce new bosons. And by varying the masses and representations of these fermions and seeing how this instability scale changes, essentially you can set a conservative upper bound on the scale of the new bosons, which we call lambda b.
So what do you mean by instability here?
I mean, so there are different things that can happen. I'll talk a bit more about it, but essentially can be either an instability in the quartic of the Higgs or in the Yukawa couplings themselves. Yeah, so those are different sorts of instability, but I will say exactly what I mean by that. Okay, so for now, all I told you is that I'm extending the standard model with fermions in a generic representation, okay? But there are actually some requirements that you can set on these fermions in order to restrict yourself to only a certain extension of the standard model. So, well, the first requirement that we want to put is essentially that, well, as I said before, these fermions are responsible for the deviation that you assume is there and you measured. The second condition is that these fermions, of course, have to be consistent with the experiment. You don't want them to be, or you don't want to be considering already an extension of the standard model that's excluded. And then the third requirement essentially is that you also want to be dealing with an extension of the standard model that doesn't introduce problems in your low energy theory. So this means that you don't want to introduce any gauge anomalies in your theory with these fermions. And if you take these requirements into account, the way to do it essentially is to introduce fermions that are in a vector-like representation of the standard model. And the reason for that is that in this way you can write a mass term for the new fermions, like a Dirac mass term, and you can essentially, you know, satisfy the experimental bounds, which you wouldn't otherwise be able to do as easily if you just had a chiral extension of the standard model instead. And also it's nice that by virtue of the fermions being vector-like, you also automatically don't introduce any gauge anomalies either. Okay, so from now on, the point is that I will consider vector-like extensions of the standard model, okay? These fermions will be in vector-like representations of the standard model gauge group. Okay, so the second thing that I want to address is, okay, I told you that we are focusing on this Higgs to WW and Higgs to ZZ couplings. Now the question is, why do we particularly focus on this? And there are actually two reasons for that. So the first one, as you can see here, is from the projection of measuring these couplings at future colliders, okay? Or in general, measuring couplings at future colliders. And Higgs to WW and Higgs to ZZ are the two plots here on the top left, okay? In particular, in each of these, the gray band is the projection for high Lumi, okay? And the other colored ones are the projections for various kinds of more future colliders. So for example, FCC or also muon colliders. And the point is that, as you can see already from here, X2WW and X2ZZ are among the couplings which are projected to be measured actually in the best way in the future among all these ones. So the order of magnitude is that more or less now we know these couplings around the 10% level, okay? So from just LHC today. But at high Lumi, we're projecting that we will get this down to around the percent level as order of magnitude. And if eventually we also get a more future collider, we'll be able to actually get this down to all the way to around the per mil level, okay, for these couplings. So, okay, what the point one essentially is that these are among the best couplings that will be constrained at some future colliders. And that's one reason that we focus on them. The second reason is that if you go ahead and look at what these couplings look like just in the standard model, they are actually generated at tree level, just from expanding the standard model Lagrangian. And so they already exist in the standard model at tree level. On the other hand, the way that these new vector-like fermions contribute to these couplings is at loop level, okay? And which means that if you want these fermions to generate a deviation in these couplings of the Higgs, then you have a competition between the tree-level standard model effect and a loop-level contribution from the fermions, from the new fermions, which means that if you want the deviation to be sizable, you need the coupling of the Yukawas of these new fermions to be quite large, which will also help with the relationship between the deviation and the instability scale. So this makes it also an attractive kind of, observable to look at if you are trying to make an argument like this. All right. So one more thing that I told you was that what we were trying to do is to take a bit of the best of both worlds, in a sense, of the model building attitude and the EFT attitude of looking at these things. So I want to spend a couple of minutes saying why this is different than just a conventional EFT intuition on the scale of new physics that you might deduce from a deviation in couplings of the Higgs. The regular EFT intuition, again, is that if you have a deviation, delta G, in some coupling of the Higgs, then you might expect this deviation to be generated from some higher dimensional operator. And then you can parameterize the deviation in this way, some order one number, let's say, times a ratio between the weak scale and the scale at which this coupling is generated, so the new physics scale. Which means that you can also, of course, estimate the new physics scale in terms of the deviation that you measured. Now, what we want to point out is that while there is this new physics scale, there is also, in addition to this, a new boson scale, okay, for which this argument applies, that in general is actually bigger, just bigger than the new physics scale, okay, bigger or equal than the new physics scale. And so said in another way, we are kind of imagining that we measure this deviation and we are already probing the scale lambda of new physics at this deviation, and we only find the new fermions, okay, up to that point. And then we want to ask, what can we say about the scale of new bosons beyond that? That's a different way of phrasing what we're trying to do. So in particular, actually, what we will find is that for deviations that are of the order of what's measurable at high Lumi, one of the conclusions that we find is that the new boson scale is approximately the same as the new physics scale, but this is not true in general. And this is actually something that we found was interesting in our results. But again, in general, lambda b is bigger than just the new physics scale. Okay, so after again, giving you a bit of the logic of what we're trying to do, let me get a bit more into the details of how we compute things and how we make this argument. The first step of what we have to calculate is actually, you know, you introduce these fermions beyond the standard model. Then you have to go ahead and calculate what deviation they induce in the couplings of the Higgs in this extension of the standard model with the new fermions. So what you actually have to do, for example, if you have to calculate your deviation at one loop, in order to do it consistently, you have to consider the electroweak sector of the standard model, including these diagrams, and you have to renormalize it together with the vector-like fermions. And the result of this procedure is that you can compute what the deviation is. This delta mu is the relative deviation in these couplings, HWW or HCZ. So relative, I mean just that it's the delta G over G. Okay, so it's the deviation in the coupling divided by the coupling in the standard model. And again, it will be a function of the parameters of the vector-like fermions, okay? So of the Yukawas and the masses of these new fermions.
So what are you assuming for the flavor?
For the flavor? I'm just assuming that, for example, there's one generation.
Can they mix with some standard model fermions?
So they can in general. So what we're trying to do is actually to, you know, again, we're trying to find the most conservative upper bound in the spirit of being model independent in this analysis. And so if they do mix, then you will have stronger constraints on them from just the experimental bounds. And then your bound will not be as conservative. So you can do that, but that will not give you the most conservative upper bound on what these new fermions are. Does that make sense? Yeah, so I mean, in principle, there are many things that you can do, but if your attempt is to find the most conservative upper bound that you can, you're trying to, we're not trying to be generic in a sense. We're trying to just find the most conservative theory that's allowed to generate this deviation. Yeah. Okay, again, this relative deviation will be a function of the Yukawas and the masses, and in order to, you know, you have, of course, to define the measured quantities in your renormalization procedure. And the result, to show you what you get out of this calculation is some function, again, for this relative deviation, which depends, again, on the Yukawas and the masses of these fermions and, of course, other parameters that you can measure in the standard model. Just to see that this makes sense, you can see that, of course, the deviation will grow with the Yukawas of the new fermions. So the more strongly they are coupled to the Higgs, the bigger the deviation will be. And on the other hand, the deviation will go to zero as you decouple the fermions. So as you make the fermions heavier and heavier. And another way that you can understand this result is just from naive dimensional analysis, so just as a cross-check that what you did was made sense. So one thing you can do is you can, you know, look at these diagrams and just estimate things again according to the naive dimensional analysis. So for example, if you take the diagram here on the right, you see that you have insertions of the Yukawa, then you have some gauge couplings. You have some loop suppression, and then if you put everything together, you see that you get something which is consistent with the actual full calculation that I showed you before. So this was the first step of the whole procedure. Okay, the second step and the part in which the instability actually comes in is that you want to actually go and calculate what happens when the theory becomes unstable. So what is determining this instability in your theory? And there are two kinds of instability that you can encounter. One is an instability in the Higgs quartic, okay, so in the quartic of the Higgs. And when the Yukawas are large, like in the regime that we are interested in, then the dominant term in ERGEs, as you go to higher energies, behaves like this. So Again, it's the running of the quartic, and you see that there is a contribution from the Yukawas of the new fermions, which scales like y to the fourth, and comes with a negative sign. Okay, so that's crucial, actually. That's because you are, again, extending the standard model with fermions that you get this minus sign. The point is that the contribution of the new Yukawas is to make the quartic more and more, well, smaller and smaller, and eventually it will make it negative as you go to higher energies. If the quartic becomes too negative, then you will have problems with the vacuum stability in your theory. Okay, so this is one kind of instability that you can have. The second is that you can have an instability which is some sort of Landau pole in the Yukawas themselves. So if the Yukawas grow bigger and bigger as you go to higher energies, again, at some point you will encounter an instability scale that you can go ahead and compute. The way you define, the way we define the instability scale, this lambda b, is as the scale at which, whatever happens the earliest of these two instabilities determines the instability scale, essentially, of course. So the first thing that goes wrong is the one that determines where your instability appears.
The second one is not a vacuum instability, right? It's not, in the potential. What is it?
Yeah, it's not a vacuum instability. You can say that, one way to say it is that if you see that your theory becomes, the coupling grows too large, that essentially you might expect something to happen. And it's a bit arbitrary exactly how you define the scale, exactly what the value of the coupling you are, cutting your theory off at.
So we say that it is not perturbative anymore, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a way to do it.
In principle, this boson doesn't need to couple to the standard model at all, right?
Yeah, that's true.
No, but it does, right? So for instance, for the Higgs quartic, you need to couple the boson.
Yeah.
Thinking
about something like ions.
Like what, sorry?
Can I have like some, let's say like the scale where the quartic becomes negative, it's like 100 TeV or like 1,000 TeV, I can have the gravitational scale at like 50 TeV and I'm done, right?
I think the point is that, well, it has to contribute in some way to this RGE, right? That's what you need.
Actually, dimensional theory or like a,
I think the point he's saying is that the cutoff, what if the cutoff of your theory is below?
So various things can happen, right? So another thing that you can have, for example, is that some different kind of dynamics, some strong dynamics comes in at that scale.
Yeah.
But then at that scale you would have resonances of this strong dynamics. So in your case, in which you're cutting off the gravity theory, you will also have new states, and some of these will be bosonic states. So that's why I would interpret that still as the new boson scale, essentially. So I'm just trying to estimate the scale at which new bosons come in, right?
Those new bosons may be not observable. For instance, yeah. If you have h squared, and then say the new boson is called, let's call it s, do h squared s squared,
mm-hmm.
So no missing with the Higgs, that boson you will never see.
Sure.
You don't need to have something observable.
I'm just trying to estimate the scale of these new bosons, right? I'm not saying that we can see them. But the crucial point for the argument is that only new bosons, only some sort of new bosons, whether being in the form of some new dynamics or the actual appearance of new fundamental bosons or something else, can rectify these instabilities, okay? So in the case of the Higgs quartic, for example, the new bosons would contribute to the opposite sign to the running, and then they would solve your problem of the quartic becoming too negative. And a similar thing would happen also for the Landau pole.
So what observable we use to fix lambda p? Is it like lifetime of the vacuum?
Yes, actually. So let me say a bit more about that in the case of the quartic, especially since it's actually the dominant case in our analysis. So in the case in which the instability is dominated by the quartic, then you have a problem with standard model vacuum decay. So what does that mean? It means that essentially, okay, we already know that even in the standard model, our vacuum is not the true vacuum of the theory, okay? We know that with the parameters of the standard model, we live in a metastable vacuum. But that's okay as long as the lifetime of the vacuum that we live in is long enough, okay? So as long as it's the lifetime of this vacuum is much, much larger, for example, than the age of the universe. Now what happens, so essentially we're living here in the metastability part of this plot. But what happens if you make the quartic more and more negative is that you're making this lifetime shorter and shorter. And eventually when you hit this negative value for the quartic, the probability of tunneling out of your vacuum, out of the standard model vacuum, out of our vacuum, within the age of the universe becomes exponentially larger and eventually approaches one quite fast, which means that, well, you can treat this as an inconsistency of your theory. So said in other words, essentially you are moving to the left in this phase space, in this plot, to the left in the quartic direction. And then, you know, eventually you're approaching the instability region. And then you cannot essentially consistently, you know, we cannot be in that region in a consistent way. Okay, so this is what I mean exactly by vacuum stability bound. Okay, so let me now show you some results for, you know, these two steps that I described for now. So on the left here, I'm showing you what the relative deviation in decoupling of the Higgs is as a function of the Yukawas of the new fermions. So I'm showing you for this for different masses of the new fermions, and the point is that you can see that even for Yukawas that are order one, I can generate deviations which are around the percent level in decouplings, which again is of the order of magnitude that's something that we might observe at high Lumi, more or less. And that, of course, depends on the masses of what these new fermions are. The plot on the right, on the other hand, is showing you what the instability scale is as a function of the same Yukawa. Okay, so I don't know if it's very clear, but okay, this is the ratio of the, it's the log 10 of the ratio between the scale lambda b and the masses of the vector-like fermions, okay? So you can see that, again, for Yukawas around order one, then this scale, this ratio, this log ratio becomes order one, which means that essentially your new bosons are one order of magnitude above the scale of what the new fermions are. Okay, so again, you're approaching the situation in which the scale of the new fermions and the scale of the new bosons are close to each other for Yukawas of order one. The second thing I'm also showing in this plot, by the way, is how this instability scale changes as you change the top Yukawa, so as you change the top mass. So if you change it by, let's say, one sigma around the measured value, then you get these various bands. And it's just to show that this is not particularly sensitive, actually, to what the top quark mass is. Which could actually already see from this plot, because you can see that this line, this division between the metastability and the instability scale is essentially vertical here. So it mostly depends just on the Yukawa. Sorry, just on the quartic.
So then you're going, like, after models that have a Yukawa that is order one with like masses of a few hundred GeVs, and those are the models that you're going after.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And then over to the Higgs with that Yukawa order one.
Yeah.
But then are you better off just doing di-Higgs production, for instance? It's just a longitudinal mode of doing H2W, for instance.
You think you're saying that would be a better kind of observable for these things?
I cannot, like, yeah, off the top of my head, but especially for heavier fermions, because the longitudinal production, so yeah, you will, what I have in mind is that instead of doing H2W, you do H longitudinal W, which is triple Higgs, essentially. So it's di-Higgs production.
Mm.
But that has an enhancement from the fact that you have a derivative on the coupling.
I see.
In other words, HWW, CC, and HH are not independent from each other, usually in this
model. Yeah, that's true.
And usually you can just like figure out their ratio just by Bolson equivalence theorem, like which dominates, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, we were looking more at again, those couplings that I showed before, just the projections, because I thought those were the ones that had the better chance of being measured in the future.
There are good examples of models where actually Dyhiggs gives you better bounds.
Yeah, I guess it's possible. I mean, of course, this all relies on the fact that you're assuming you're measuring a deviation first. So, I mean, I think if, again, as you say, you observe a deviation or you observe something in another channel, then you can probably do a similar analysis for a different one.
Those guys are super light. I will naively assume that the deviation on the tri-Higgs from those guys is pretty big.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to estimate that off the top of my head, but I don't know if it's bigger or not than what we looked at.
It's just the XZZ coupling as well, though, right?
Yeah, so that's what we're looking at, HWW and HZZ. Yeah.
I mean, sigma ZH is constrained by 0.5% or something in future colliders, right? So that's a very strong.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. But there's an enhancement from the energy in the longitudinal mode. So that's, it's unclear to me which one is bigger.
Yeah, maybe we can compare. I mean, I'm happy, of course, if you find something else in which you can look for this. So.
Naively, I will say that the enhancement with respect to that will be somewhat like a mass of the fermion squared divided by Bev squared. So, yeah, something like, I don't know.
Factor of a few, yeah.
Because, I mean, I really remember that, like, those...
But then you can measure them just as well? I guess that's also the question.
Measure it as well, but...
Yeah, I guess it's maybe a competition of that enhancement with how well you can measure them compared to this.
So, for instance, for a mass, for a fermion with a mass of 300 GeVs, coupled to the Higgs with an order 1 Yukawa, well, actually with a 0.5 Yukawa, you get a Dyhiggs production enhanced by a factor of 2. So for order of 1, will be enhanced by a factor of like 8.
Because it's like the cube?
Yeah, it's like the same thing that you have. But I don't remember what are the enhancements that are measured now in Dyhiggs.
Yeah, I don't know if it was among the things that I had in my previous plot with it.
But in the cross section.
Yeah, so it's not going to be here, I guess.
Okay, I think like current bounds were like order 10 of the standard model Dyhiggs cross section, but.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, but by definition, sorry. Yeah, so by definition, like the high luminosity is trying to measure the quark, right? So the cubic.
Yeah.
So by definition, the high luminosity will have a sensitivity that is order of the Dyhiggs cross section.
Okay.
Of the order of the standard model one.
Right.
So these guys, for a Yukawa that is order 1, with 300 GeVs, gives you a Dyhiggs cross-section that is 8 times the standard model 1.
Okay.
So you will naively expect that it's...
So to see it, you have to be like, 10% level to see it, you're saying? 10% deviation.
With those fermions at that scale and that coupling, the Dyhiggs production cross-section that you predict, it's a factor of 10 larger than in the standard model.
Okay.
The high luminosity will have a sensitivity to the standard model Dyhiggs.
Okay. So you would definitely see it.
So you should be able to see it. So WW, CC and HH can never be separated from each other.
Yeah. That makes sense, yeah. Of course, yeah.
But yeah, it's like mother of like little numbers.
Yeah. But yeah, we can look at it later. Course.
So what's the difference between like the blue, red band and the yellow?
Yeah, so the kind of two regions in the plot are different masses, and then the kind of, you know, the two bands in the same are just by changing the top. Yes.
So one diverges.
So I think, so let me say it again. On one of them, actually, no, that was wrong. So on one case, so because there are two Yukawas that you have in your theory, in this band, you're fixing the second Yukawa to zero, And in this band, you're fixing the second Yukawa to 1.
I see.
Makes sense? Yeah. And then you're so this YC is the second Yukawa, and then this axis is just Y, which is the other Yukawa that you're not fixing.
It makes a difference whether one or
two. Yes, whether the relationship between the two Yukawas is. And again, okay, so, and the band here is changing the top Yukawa. Okay, again, I told you that in general, you can start with a generic representation for these new fermions, but it's nice if you have some argument that you can use to restrict yourself to a smaller set of things you have to consider. So in particular, one thing you can do is to see how your deviation scales with the color representation of the new fermions. So this is what I showed you before, and it's the scaling of the coupling deviation with the parameters of the fermion theory. And you can also estimate how this changes if you have a certain representation of SU3 for the fermions. And in particular, there is an overall factor of R, where R is the dimension of the SU3 representation. Now, what you actually want to do is, let's say that we take the example in which the instability is determined by this Landau pole, but you can also do a similar thing for the quartic. Then also there will be an overall R factor from the dimension. And then if you want to compare situations that have the same instability scale, you can rescale your Yukawa in this way, which is effectively the same as introducing a Toft coupling. It's the equivalent of a Toft coupling in your theory. And then you can rewrite, again, the coupling deviation in terms of this rescaled Yukawa. And then if you want this to be consistent with some experimental measurement, this has to be less than the equivalent quantity where you are replacing now the mass with the experimental bound on the mass of these particles. Well, the way that this scales is that this quantity, this delta G, has to be smaller the bigger your dimension R of the representation is. And also, if you have colored particles, this experimental bound will also become stronger and stronger, which means that for the same instability scale, you are restricted to consider smaller deviations if your particles are colored, which means that overall, if you want to consider the most conservative theory, then you can just consider the lowest SU3 representation. So essentially singlets under SU3, vector-like leptons. And then you can write the representation for your new fermions in this way, essentially fixing to 1 the SU3 representation and leaving generic the SU2 and hypercharge representations. So it turns out that there is not a similar simple argument for that allows you to exclude higher, let's say, SU2 representation or hypercharge in general. But it turns out that in practice, from what we find, actually the lowest representations are also the ones that give the most conservative bound in those cases. So we show various plots, and you can see that that's the case. Okay, finally, the third step for putting everything together is to determine what the experimental bounds on these fermions are. And the dominant one comes from just electroweak precision, essentially, okay? So just as a reminder, you have this ellipse in the S and T plane, electroweak precision already coming from LEP constrain you to be within this blue ellipse, more or less, to be consistent with the experimental bounds. And of course, the standard model is falling in there. And then on top of this, there are some collider constraints that you have to take into account on the masses of these fermions. So now, if you put everything together, you can translate all the experimental bounds in the planes of the masses and the couplings of these vector-like fermions. And you get something like this. So again, the colored bands are coming from collider searches for these things, while the gray bands are just the constraints you get from S and T. And you see that in a large range of masses, actually, the electroweak precision constraints are the dominant ones for what these things are allowed to be. And that's already, you know, a strong statement for, of course, for how these you know, fermions are constrained by electroweak precision.
That depends. I mean, there's, I mean, actually, I thought that like with a vector like doublet and a singlet, there's if you're setting the yukawas to be equal.
Yeah, in this one, yes.
There was a custodial symmetry that there's no T parameter. Like I'm sure, I'm absolutely sure that the famous singlet doublet model with vector like has a custodial symmetry with the yukawas equal to each other. So there's no T parameters. So there's no electroweak precision constraints that are strong.
Well, but what's the story there?
It's a funny thing that if you said that you
have I know that you have the custodial symmetry, and then
you just have S, and then you have T at higher loop, but it's just too small.
I mean, I know that I have to think about what the breaking of the custodial symmetry is.
Yeah, it depends if you take, I don't remember exactly what, so there's, if you put just one singlet.
Ah, but because the, let's see. I think maybe the masses can break the.
The masses can break it.
Can break the custodial symmetry, yeah.
You're setting them to be equal, which I'm assuming that you are.
Yeah, I have to look again at what exactly we were setting for this plot. Yeah, I know what you mean, but I have to check again for this part. Okay, but okay. So the point is that you have to, you know, take this into account, of course, modulo custodial symmetry. Okay, another point that I wanted to make finally is to point out that, okay, you might argue that you also have some constraints on this scale just coming from considering strongly coupled theories, of course. And then you might ask, of course, whether our perturbative analysis is really the most conservative thing you can do. And the way you compare these two situations is by you know, considering a correction that would come from a strongly coupled theory. So typically, what happens is you get corrections to the couplings of the Higgs that scale like the ratio of some power of the ratio V over F, where F is the confinement scale of this strongly coupled theory. And then the new resonances in your theory, including bosonic resonances, would be at the scale 4 pi F. So in this particular situation, you would have this deviation and you would associate the new boson scale with 4 pi F. On the other hand, in our weakly coupled theories, then you have a correction which has this form, which means you can define an effective confinement scale, an equivalent F effective, which goes like 4 pi m over y squared. Okay, so now the question is, for a fixed deviation, which one is the highest scale? So which one gives you the most conservative upper bound? And we find that in practice, in most of the cases that we study in our plots, the most conservative situation is indeed the one with the weakly coupled theory. So indeed, in that case, you get a more conservative bound by just studying the weakly coupled theory compared to the strongly coupled one. All right, so finally, let me show you you know, the result of the whole thing. So now I'm showing you this instability scale as a function of the coupling deviation for the case of HWW and for the case in which I'm taking this doublet plus singlet extension of the standard model. So here I have different lines, of course, for different masses for what these new fermions can be. And again, as Daniel was pointing out, we're looking in the range of a few hundred GV to a TeV. And you can see that, well, the first thing that you can see from the plot is that actually I'm not even able to extend it to things that are of order percent level, which is what you would be able to measure at high LUMI, which means that, you know, within the assumption of what we are doing, so within the assumption that you only have fermionic extensions of the standard model, you cannot generate percent deviation in decouplings of the Higgs with fermions alone. Okay, so this means that observing a deviation in decouplings at high Lumi necessarily requires at least also bosons. So either only bosons or fermions and bosons, but you cannot do it with fermions alone, essentially. And that's because the instability scale in that situation is so low, which is the statement that I was giving you before, that for deviations of the order of high Lumi, then the new boson scale is also coincident with coincides with the new the fermion scale, the new physics scale. And then the second thing you can see is that even for deviations that are of the order of what you might observe at future colliders, so order per mil level, this is the projection for these future colliders, then for these particular masses of the fermions, the instability scale is around two orders of magnitude above the scale of the new fermions. So let's say that you're taking roughly into account these masses, then you would expect new bosons under 100 TeV, very roughly.
I mean, I assume that lambda b is always a growing function, right? Of
it decreases as you increase the Yukawa, right? So as you increase the Yukawa, you're making the deviation bigger and bigger, and you are encountering your instabilities. So of course, yeah. Yeah, so as you see, I mean, as I increase, does that make sense? But because here I'm also, so here this M max is the maximum, is also the fermion mass. So I'm dividing by the fermion mass here, by the maximum fermion mass in the theory. So there's why there is this relationship, but of course, M max is different for the different lines. So that's why you have this particular ordering here. Okay, the second thing that you can do actually is to try to make these fermions as light as possible while still being consistent with experimental bounds. And it turns out that just roughly what you can do is you can get away with something that's around 50 GeV if your lightest state is just neutral in this doublet plus singlet extension. And then you see that even for deviations that are observable at future colliders, then I can decouple the instability scale to be quite high, of order, let's say, the GATT scale, which means that in this case, you don't have a strong bound from just this instability argument. But on the other hand, this comes at the price of having fermions which are quite light and potentially observable at even high Lumi. Okay, so that's kind of the other regime of the things that you can do. And so here I'm showing 50 GeV, and on the right it's 100 and 150, but of course the statement is similar.
Sorry, the gray region is excluded
by SNT, electroweak
so
precision.
That means that you don't expect to have deviations that are measured by high Lumi, for example, cannot happen because they are already excluded?
These are the bounds from electroweak precision in this particular extension in which you have only fermions, right? There is also some degree of things that you can do to alleviate those constraints, as also Daniel was pointing out, in the sense that you can try to restore, for example, custodial symmetry in some situations. And that comes at the price, typically, of introducing new states with other couplings to the standard model. And then you typically alleviate the electroweak precision bounds, but on the other hand, you also lower the instability scale because, again, you're adding more stuff that's coupled, for example, to the Higgs, because you're trying to restore this symmetry. So, in a sense, the electroweak precision tests are a strong constraint, but also there is something that you can do to get around them, at least partially. So now I told you that we find just in practice that the strongest constraint comes, the stronger constraints come from the theories in which the SU2 representations are the smallest. And in fact, here I'm showing you what happens if you take higher representations for SU2 and also actually for hypercharge. And you can see again, the instability scale in those cases becomes smaller and smaller. So indeed, those are the most conservative theories, the ones with the lower SU2 representation.
I have a question about this fermion thing, because at some point, I mean, two things might happen. So the first is that for like n equal 5, but maybe also with 2 equal 3, SU2 develops a lambda pole.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And second, the lambda pole, so the SU2 coupling should contribute positively to lambda as G2 effort.
Yeah, that's right,
so
yeah.
Do you always have the instability, or at some point you have instead a lambda-lambda pole?
Yeah, it can happen that you have, if you take... So actually, the reason we took 3 plus 4 and then we considered the representations in which this Landau pole happens too early, and then we didn't go, of course, to those representations of SU2. But that, typically, that happens actually more for the 5 plus 6 or around there, we found. But yes, as you point out, it's true that you have to take into account also the SU2 Landau pole in this. And it's also true that that you will have a contribution from the to the running from SU2, from the SU2 coupling. But in these cases, I think the Yukawas are typically still dominating. Again, it's another thing that we check, but the Yukawas are still order one. So I think you still get the instability that's dominated by the Yukawa. But in any case here, I mean, we're solving the full RGEs when we do this thing. So we're not just taking into account that term that I showed you from the Yukawas that dominates.
So then, for example, if you have a quartic that develops a Landau pole, I guess that the completion is not a boson.
Yeah, it can be something else. Yeah, that's true. So it depends what's dominating the instability scale. But again, yeah, you have to check which one happens first. And as long as the instabilities that I pointed out are the ones that appear the earliest, then this applies. But it's something that we check. Again, in the case of hypercharge, you have a similar thing. Actually, here you can see a situation in which the instability scale is almost independent of the deviation, and that happens when indeed this is dominated by the Landau pole instead of the instability in the quartic. And also another thing to point out is that, you know, of course, when hypercharge is large, electroweak precision constraints are even stronger. So, for example, in that case, your whole plot is grayed out. A similar situation happens for HZZ. So qualitatively, it's very similar. The difference is that just numerically, HZZ is actually gives you a smaller deviation, which means that if you want to fix the deviation, you have to consider bigger Yukawas, which means that the instability scale becomes even lower, so just numerically, HGZ has lower instability scales. A similar thing happens again for higher SU2 and hypercharge representations. Just to conclude, one of the things that we found for the case of high Lumi is that if you want to measure a deviation at high Lumi LHC, then that magnitude of a deviation requires new bosons. You cannot do it just with new fermions. On the other hand, for deviations that are of the order of what you can measure at a future collider, so around the per mil level, you either need light new fermions around 50 or 100 GeV, or you need new bosons which are roughly under 100 TeV. You can extend this analysis to a number of different observables. So, for example, you could do a systematic study of H gamma gamma and HZ gamma, but there are other things that you might imagine doing that are interesting. I think this was our goal, hopefully, was to just give an example of situations in which quantitatively you can see how these couplings are powerful probes of new physics. And thanks a lot.
from the audience here or so?
Yeah.
So, yeah, in this parameter space that you're able to probe, is there any, can you fit like a thermal dark matter candidate in there?
Yeah, so I think if these things are stable, then it might be tough because you might have stronger constraints just from maybe overclosing, overclosure or things like that. So typically the easiest thing to do is to maybe give to these fermions a tiny coupling, very, very tiny coupling to the standard model, so you don't have to worry about them being stable. So that's the easiest thing to do.
But then you don't see them.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, I guess.
Is there any way to make a vector-like model be dark matter?
Yeah,
to the Higgs with those couplings, it just decays.
Yeah, I don't know, yeah.
So when you go to the Higgs, then you just decay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless it's tiny.
Unless it's tiny, but then you...
Yeah, so yeah, I guess that's it.
We've had a lot of questions already during the talk, so let's thank Gabriel again.
Thank you very much.